If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Today is Wednesday. It is July 15th, 2026, and it's 2:43 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is another edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2. Remember, you can always watch the Mincing Rascals on YouTube, and you can hear a broadcast version of this Saturday nights on WGN Radio. We're joined today by former Tribune columnist and the proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel, Eric Zorn. Kate Plies is here, former Chicago columnist and reporter. She writes the history website Roseland Chicago 1972. And Austin Berg is here, the executive director of the Chicago Policy Center, the publisher of The Last Ward. Austin, you've been away for a couple of weeks. Good to have you back on the panel. We hope you're doing
great
well.
To be here.
All good. Kate, good to see you, and Eric as well. I have to say, guys, just out of the gate, that I noticed that the Chicago Tribune had an editorial, and it said something we said on last week's episode, so we don't need to talk a lot about it. But they said that elected officials owe us more transparency about their medical issues, about their health and well-being. That was a Mitch McConnell conversation. Somebody told me, my wife said to me one this weekend, she goes, "Did you hear that Lindsey Graham died?" And I said, "You mean Mitch McConnell?" She says, "No. Lindsey Graham." We didn't see that coming. So maybe it's not all that relevant. But as a result, there was a lot of reporting since our last episode about how many members of Congress have died in this session. It's like six or eight. And then how many of them are very, very old?
The numbers, I think, are that over a third are over 70.
Right.
And, you know, that in and of itself, not the end of the world, obviously, but it is substantially higher skewed than it used to be. There used to be more like a third of the lawmakers were under 45 in something like, I think it's the 1983 session, and now it's a minuscule number.
They do not give up those seats, and incumbency is so powerful, and people live longer. I had to laugh a little at John Stewart's take on the picture of Mitch McConnell that his staff released this week. It shows him smiling, reading the paper next to his wife. He's got a nice, crisp shirt on. It looks very staged. It looks so staged. You wonder what they're hiding here. And they were trying to communicate that he is engaged. I don't know how engaged he is. I don't know how engaged he ever was.
I don't like age limits on political office.
I do.
And I think it's a slippery slope, too, on the health stuff. And I find those proposals to be treating the symptoms rather than the disease oftentimes. Like, typically what you want to solve for is more competitive elections or not having one person in office for a long time, which those fixes would be more about gerrymandering or term limits. But if you just think about, I get why Rahm Emanuel's saying we need an age limit, because that's like a populist thing to say. But imagine a 75-year-old today versus a 75-year-old 50 years ago. I mean, and that's going to keep, that change is going to keep accelerating. People are going to keep living longer. So I think having that be a static number is not a great idea. And we'd be better served talking about having more competitive elections and maybe stopping entrenchment in office rather than people's health and age.
But in your world, Chuck Grassley would still be heading up that hearing today. Chuck Grassley, who is
third in line to be president at age 92.
And he ain't going anywhere.
I just had to say that. I'm sorry. It cracks me up that the youngster here is the one who doesn't want the age limits.
Yeah.
And I see what you're saying. I totally see what you're saying. But on the other hand, it's not always possible to cure the disease, right? I mean, yes.
Yeah, throw me a Band-Aid.
The age is due to the diseases ongoing that are so awful regarding our elections. But when are we going to actually solve those problems? Whereas it might be possible to put some age restrictions in place, which at this point would be completely, you know, sensible. The vast majority of people are behind it. Several polls just in the last couple of months show basically 80% of Americans, pretty much across the board, are down with it. And I see what you're saying about people living longer. I mean, every 10 years you hear an update of, you know, 30 is the new 40 or the opposite, right? But that's part of why we have these people hanging on as long as they are, because of our extra longevity. It's going to be a while before the extra longevity translates into, and we are as fit and ready as we used to be.
Let's not confuse living longer with living better.
Don't go together.
One of the problems that they have with longevity issues is that, yes, you can keep the human body alive, but they have really done very little in the way of progress in terms of controlling the deterioration of the mind. And so, my father was 94 and in very sound mind. My mother is 94 and has almost no mind left. And there was nothing we could do about it. So we may be prolonging that age, but I don't know if we are prolonging the age of competence and lucidity necessarily. I think there are problems with term limits. Because you have too many term limits, you basically cede control of government to the lobbyists and the careerists in Springfield or Washington. Although it does seem to me like maybe 12 years in the U.S. Senate or 12 years in the House is probably enough, and you should go back to the farm after that. But, I think that we could say we don't want any president to be elected or can't be sworn into office after age 75. That seems reasonable to me in terms of just a safeguard. Again, I mean, we have bottom age limits. We say you can't be president until you're 35. Does that really make sense? Aren't there 30-year-olds who are perfectly capable of being? How old are you, Austin? Are you 35?
34
yet?
Today. It's my birthday.
Yeah, Happy birthday! Oh, really? I would gladly have Austin. I would rather much prefer Austin as president than a lot of octogenarians.
Thank you. No, but I think it's going to be just as difficult politically to pass an age limit as it is, depending on what it is, as term limits. So my thing is just go with term limits because you want to protect against sort of this. If voters want to elect somebody who's over 75 in their district because they think that's the most qualified person, who am I to say that they're wrong?
Well, that does get into the whole issue of ballot access, about whether, a convicted felon should be able to run for state office or federal office.
Well, blanket law is perfect for every individual case, but I don't think any state or municipality, certainly a place as big as Chicago or Illinois, the United States would suffer because the one person you wanted isn't there. I'll bet number two, if we're doing it right, would be fairly qualified as well.
If people of the district want to elect somebody who, or like Dianne Feinstein, who, died in office a couple of years ago at something like 90, and it was clear that she had not been functioning, that her aides had been steering her and telling her what to do at hearings for years. And there was the other one, a representative in Texas, who stopped showing up for a little while, and a reporter found that she was living in a memory care unit in an assisted living center, and her family was keeping it secret. But my point really is that an incredibly tiny percentage of incumbents lose in the primaries. The districts are so drawn for the incumbents. It's just so hard to get them out of there. It seems like only fair to give the voters one thing in their favor, that being something like 75 for an upper limit, which again, how is that unreasonable? That's a totally reasonable age.
I'm also for age limits on driver's licenses as well. And nobody in my audience likes that because I have an older listening audience. And they go, John, I'm 80, I can drive. I'm saying, okay, just at least prove it every year. But we've raised the driver's age for mandatory tests. And I think you should start getting tested every year to prove your driver's competence at 73, pick a number, but it's way too high right now, Eric.
Well, maybe 5 years older than I am at all times.
As long as it's 1 year older than Eric, it'll be okay.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, this actually, talk about ballot access and so on, it makes me think of this story with the succession of Chuy Garcia and how it's so difficult in Illinois for independent candidates to get on the ballot. The signature requirements are so much higher for independent candidates than they are for established party candidates. It's absurd. And so it looks like the independent candidate may be knocked off the ballot. And Chuy Garcia is going to get away, probably was going to get away with it anyways, but he's going to get away with that sleazy trick that he pulled, which is waiting until the absolute last minute, then saying, oh, I'm not going to run for re-election. And then, it seems like my chief of staff has already gathering petitions and she's on the ballot and nobody else can get there. He's going to get away with that. They're going to get away with that because, in large part, it looks like, certainly because of this signature requirement for independent candidates.
We got an email.
Well, at least he got censored. So that's something.
He got censored. Know. Well, yeah, but that what does that do?
I mean, it calls doesn't it do out. Anything for the voters, but
yeah.
He didn't get away with it as much as he thought he would.
He got a stern scolding in the Picayune Sentinel.
Well, we did get this email to the radio station. Hey, John Williams, it is interesting that you object to Lindsey Graham's sister filling out his term for a few months because she has no record or political experience. Here in Illinois, we are about to be represented for 6 more years by Juliana Stratton, a person with no real record or experience, our lieutenant governor. Billionaire J.B. Pritzker, for some reason, decided to step in at the 11th hour and spend millions of his own fortune to get her elected. I'll take exception with some of that. He didn't step in at the 11th hour. I think he stepped in at the first hour. But this listener says, previously, she spent 2 years in Springfield as a representative, and does anybody remember her as lieutenant governor? I do not agree with Rajna Krishnamurthy's politics, but he seemed popular and represented his district well. He really got stabbed in the back. One wonders what Pritzker and Illinois' Democrat Party had against Raja to spend millions of the billionaire's dollars to defeat him. This is Illinois politics as usual.
Juliana Stratton's political career is really interesting to me in terms of all. It's almost people often forget that Brandon Johnson's political career started because of the soda tax. Essentially, that was what allowed Brandon Johnson to get on to the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Similarly, Juliana Stratton's political career began when Ken Duncan, if people remember that name, was a state rep who would vote with Rauner and against then House Speaker Mike Madigan on a couple of big labor issues, and Madigan put a hit out on Ken Duncan, and even got Barack Obama to cut an ad in this random sort of weird district, West Side House district that Ken Duncan was in, got him out. Juliana Stratton served in that seat for 2 years and then was elevated to this lieutenant governor.
Wow.
So they have a point in terms of there's been, you could call it skill or luck, but Juliana Stratton has had a glide path to the very top.
Yes.
In terms of those political races, if you think about state rep, then lieutenant governor, then Senate, U.S. Senate.
Yeah, true enough, but at least in those cases, voters had a say. I mean,
for sure.
Pritzker put his thumb on the scale. Raja spent more than Juliana Stratton, I believe.
Oh, he had more money, that's for sure. I think he was saving for the general.
She had enough, and you know, I don't think it was necessarily anti-Raja sentiment, but it was more J.B. Pritzker is courting the African-American vote, and he had an African-American lieutenant governor who wanted to run for Senate. If he had turned his back on her and not supported her, that would have been a problem for him. I don't think it was really anti-Raja so much. I just wanted to add, I'm sure that Austin has some thoughts about the signature requirement for independent candidates.
I mean, yeah, it's a cottage industry in Chicago, petition challenges, in a way it is not in any other big city in the country. And we're seeing this most recently with our the first ever fully elected school board in the city of Chicago, where many candidates are facing signature challenges. There was a heart-wrenching story of one woman who wanted to file signatures in a given school board district and had gotten all the required signatures, but had labeled it as the incorrect sub-district when filing them, and you know, did all of this work and got kicked off the ballot. This has been a tactic used by political machines ranging from the old Madigan machine to CTU, and now new organizations are challenging candidates. But if you look at this industry, the scope of it is crazy. So WBEZ did an analysis a few years ago finding from 1983 to 2023, just in Chicago municipal elections, this is just city council, mayor, other municipal offices, there was more than 2,100 attempts legally to kick people off the ballot. I mean, it's just a crazy use of resources. Places like Denver have fixed this by simply allowing folks to carry around an iPad with an app on it and get signatures that way, basically eliminated this whole cottage industry overnight. And the extreme end of this is in Indiana, many local and even state offices, you don't have to get any signatures to get on the ballot. You just need to prove you live there, and then you can get on the ballot. So, the ballot access rules in Illinois and in Chicago are very undemocratic, really need to be reformed.
Is the cottage industry the people that get the signatures or the people that challenge the signatures?
Both. I mean, people, you would hear, sort of infamously, Governor Pritzker at some point was paying over $10 a signature to get certain candidates on the ballot, and maybe even himself in previous election cycles. And so there are all sorts of firms that are sometimes fly by night that try to get people to get these signatures, and there's a lot of fraud. So for a lot of candidates, they might say, oh, there's a firm that can help me get these, and then they turn their signatures up, they're all bad. So you really have to know a guy, or at least know what the pitfalls are before even running for office and getting this whole crazy world of signatures. The best depiction of this in popular media was in the movie City So Real, or the documentary series City So Real, directed by the guy who did Hoop Dreams, where they follow Neil Salas Griffin, the former mayoral candidate, into this whole shadowy process in the basement of the Chicago Board of Elections. And you see how ridiculous the whole thing really is.
I have to look for that. I haven't seen that.
Best docuseries on Chicago politics I've ever seen, too. I highly recommend that. City So Real.
So
if we get rid of the whole Byzantine business of the signature requirements, we are going to lose potentially good politicians, and we're going to lose some good stories. And I will give you two examples. First, as I mentioned not too long ago, and I forget why it came up, but let's not forget, President Barack Obama got into his very first office by challenging the ballot signatures of all four of his opponents and getting them all thrown off.
Including Alice Palmer.
Including Alice Palmer, yes.
Who was the incumbent. And
the longtime incumbent who had been his mentor, yes.
Really?
Yeah, I know. Great story.
That changes everything for me. Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that.
Back in the early 70s, everyone remembers that it was a huge scandal that Ed Hanrahan was kept on the ballot to be state's attorney by Mayor Daley, even after the raid, the Black Panther raid, that killed several of the Black Panthers. And Mayor Daley decided about 2 days before, no, actually the day before the deadline for getting Ed Hanrahan off the ballot, he suddenly changed his mind and announced it that morning. The army of machine people went out and collected signatures in a single day, like 10,000 signatures for the person he had decided would replace Ed Hanrahan on the ballot. A lot of offices in City Hall just had to be closed because all the workers were just too busy going and collecting signatures. And
you're right. These are good stories. This is all horrible, but these are great stories. I would rather sacrifice the good stories for a cleaner process, but those are great stories.
Okay. And if a process is completely open, don't you get these like bedsheet long ballots where, like in California, I believe the governor's race, the threshold for getting on that ballot, I don't know if it was zero or not, but there were just scores of names, I believe. And so I don't know if I'm in favor of that, but some middle ground where it's not totally onerous. I mean, the truth is that these politicians who go out and gather signatures are not locating people who actually support them, right? I mean, they're people who are like stopped on the street and said, "Will you sign this petition?" And they're like, and so maybe to get the person to go away, they sign this. They sign for it. I've been out in Oak Park fairly often, and I get asked I'm at the farmers market out there playing music, and I get asked fairly often to sign petitions. Like, I don't know these people. They know I don't know these people. I don't sign them because I don't live here. But they're not actually like, "I support your candidacy." They're like, "Yes, get off my porch. Here's my signature." And this, which is why it basically is not a measure of support, but it's a measure of how many people you can marshal to go out and do this. How organized?
Which is a thing,
right? But it has nothing to do with like popular support. Like, your signature means you're going to vote for that person.
No, but I don't think it should either. My threshold's very low, Eric. A lot of times I would see them standing in my CTA or my Metra stop. And I think if you're there at 6 in the morning and it's snowing and you've got a clipboard, and maybe you're the candidate, maybe you're a supporter, I'm impressed, right? Like, I don't know a lot about you. All I'm saying is you deserve to run. So unless there's a big red flag, like, "And we are the Nazis," I would say, I don't care what. But otherwise, I appreciate the effort. That's why I signed the petition.
Okay.
And leave me alone. What about this? Is 9 a lot or a little? That's how many times ICE agents have used deadly force, killed someone, since the Trump administration began its immigration crackdown. The number may actually be higher. One man running from agents in Florida Tuesday was struck and killed by a semi-tractor trailer. The most recent shootings by ICE agents in Maine and Texas included the death of one man who was not the target of the investigation. Agents say he targeted them with his vehicle, but we don't know for sure since they weren't using body cams. DHS Secretary Tom Homan said since Democrats have held up the funding, not all agents have yet been equipped and trained to use them. Gang, what's your thought about this story? Here we go again. It's just like these guys are bad at their jobs. I mean, you should not have to be killing people, or the result of your best efforts should not be that they'll possibly die. Sometimes people get away, or you got to find a better way to do it. I'm right about that, right?
Yeah, they did not have body cameras in this latest instance in Texas, for instance. But I saw at least one pretty intricately done splicing together of all the different, cameras that were around,
Ring cameras and stuff. Yeah,
and man, a lot. We're all being watched all the time. We should know that. But he did continue to drive the car after they were, trying to stop him. Really slowly. It's the
guy that was driving it in circles.
Yeah.
That one. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. But the main thing that I was thinking about, besides the fact that he was driving incredibly slowly, he was not trying to peel off. So he's driving super, super slowly. And in addition, they are still doing the insane tactic of somebody holding onto the car door and basically putting themselves in the way of the car and forcing themselves to be dragged along with the car as if he was trying to stop an errant kite and was going to physically be able to just stop
pull
that
it back,
car.
Yeah.
I mean, how many different times do we have to hear one after another law enforcement professionals telling us, "We don't train our people to do this. We train them not to get in the way of a car."
Yeah.
And still the ICE people continue this tactic. It's just nuts.
And then they shoot through the windshield.
And how long does it take?
Oh, yeah, and there were two bullet holes right through his windshield.
And how long does it take to train someone to use a body camera? I'm sure it's maybe a couple of hours at the most. In one of the text threads, one of our members of the Mincing Rascals family, Steve Bertrand, who's office I'm using as my Zoom background right now, how is it that they basically something to the effect of, how is it that they don't have money for body cameras, yet we found billions and billions of dollars to attack Iran? It's like there's money there. The federal government has the money to do this if they want to. And this excuse about the car being used as a weapon, we saw them lie about that over and over in Chicago. The cameras, the video that's caught in these altercations, people almost never, I mean, I can't remember an incident where you've seen them like driving their car at officers. It does happen in law enforcement around the country. Someone will try to use their car as a weapon, clearly. But in these instances, it's not happening. They're lying about this, and nobody seems to want to do anything about it. ICE, what was it, yesterday, on Tuesday, said we're not going to do car chases anymore.
Right.
And Trump throws a fit and says, yes,
today,
you are going to do
car
chases on Wednesday. Yeah. It's like, and we know from experience that vehicle chases can be deadly, not just for the driver or the pursuer, but for pedestrians who are just or people in other cars. And for what? Often these people are like, you know, your archetypal tamale vendors.
The whole debate to me, or this whole controversy, stems from completely different views of what immigration enforcement is supposed to be. And when you think about body cameras, you often think about civilian law enforcement. And the revolution of body cameras came from the fact that there were a lot of high-profile cases of police shooting unarmed civilians and killing them. And so activists on the left said, we need to have police body cameras. And slowly, the police realized, hey, the footage found on these body cameras also can exonerate and prove that officers did nothing wrong in cases where they didn't.
Yeah.
And there was this nice synergy there, and you've seen body cameras spread throughout the country in law enforcement offices. At the core of that revolution in law enforcement was this question of community policing and trust, and that in order to build trust with the community, this video would be a record of what actually happened, so that you wouldn't have there would just be a clear record of the truth in some of these really dramatic interactions between police and civilians. Now, when you look at ICE, there's, I think, this incredible belligerence in many of their operations that stems from their view as basically a militarized force and not a traditional law enforcement agency. And that's where I think this gets lost. And a military force does not need to establish trust in the community. They just operate. And that's completely the wrong approach when it comes to law enforcement within the borders of our country. So that's at the core of this, I think.
That's an interesting point. And when they say, well, we don't have any video, but the guy tried to use his vehicle as a weapon, Eric is right. They said that in Chicago and Minneapolis, but then we did find the video, and we found that they weren't being truthful. So that explanation now, if this guy, in fact, did try and use his vehicle as a weapon, they have no credibility. And I'll also add to that ICE was previously given $20 million for cameras. Tom Homan told Caitlin Collins on CNN this week that they were only given $20 million, and this is because the Democrats had held up the funding. So there was $20 million they could use for body cams. He said that as more money came in, they would use it to further equip their agents. What she didn't ask was, well, how much money do you need? So I did a little back-of-the-envelope math. The average body cam, you can get one for as little as $100. The good ones look like they cost about $1,000. How many body cameras can you buy with $20 million? You could buy 20,000. How many ICE agents are there? 22,000. Literally, they have had enough money for everybody to get body cams. But they've been slow rolling them out. And I don't know how long it takes to train somebody to use one of those things, but I think there's a button and you push it and then it starts to record. I mean, really, how much training do you need and how much money do you need? It sounds like they're just using that as an excuse to operate militarily rather than the way they should be.
Everyone knows how to use a camera now. Everyone knows. It's not 1945.
Go to a concert.
Everybody is constantly filming.
Let's go to Chicago for a second. While the Trump administration has told immigration agents to suspend most vehicle stops, U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement agents have made as many as 17 arrests in Chicago in the last week. In January, Mayor Brandon Johnson issued an executive order directing Chicago police to investigate federal immigration agents and potentially seek charges against them. The Sun-Times today mentioned that Alderman Jesse Fuentes from the 26th grilled the chief assistant state's attorney of policy and external affairs about the office's handling of federal agents. Said Fuentes, "Your office has refused to bring charges to ICE agents who have shot, killed, and assaulted individuals in Cook County." In February, Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke said an executive order requiring cops to document potential violations by federal agents could raise issues of political interference. This would jeopardize the criminal cases, she said. So I don't know what is worse, Tom Homan or Todd Blanche marching to the president's orders, or O'Neill Burke not marching at all. Is it possible for us to charge them or arrest them with criminal violations?
Well, my understanding was that O'Neill Burke's problem was that Johnson's executive order specifically wanted his office to be involved in the referral process. And that's what made it political. It should go directly from the police department to her office, his office, the mayor's office should have nothing to do with it. And my understanding from the reporting this week on the hearing that's going to be held on what's even going on with the implementation of that executive order is that he, you know, never took that out. So it's still a problem. And the police department was supposed to write up protocol for how police officers were supposed to, you know, implemented in terms of getting information, et cetera, together for the report. And they never did that. They may or may not want to do it, and it may be partially their fault, but they also have not been given those implementation rules.
I wonder if the officers aren't a little sympathetic to the agent's activities. They're maybe on page with them, and they're loath to now try and write these guys up or get their badge number down and then report them. But the mayor said you need to pull up a full report, and they haven't been very cooperative.
It's two sides of the same coin that we've been talking about. Same way that ICE is being used as this political tool. I thought the way that the mayor's office has handled this from a public safety perspective has been way overly political and not professional. And an example of this was in Fran Spielman's story on this issue. There's a quote that the mayor said at his press conference in January where he issued these executive orders. He said, "We need to send a clear message. If the federal government will not hold these rogue actors accountable, then Chicago will do everything in our power to bring these agents to justice." And he does this huge press conference, and all of his political allies are behind him.
What's so bad about that statement?
What's so bad about it is what this other quote from the same piece. And Johnson's telling reporters in March, after further review, he didn't believe that a new police policy was necessary to implement the order. Quote, "It turns out that the policy that they have in place is applicable to what we're asking them to do," Johnson said at the time. This is not like make-believe, pretend stuff. You are the head of a massive law enforcement agency. And months after you do this massive press conference, you're saying, "Oh, after further review, it turns out all this stuff's already, you know, that this stuff's already here. They already have all the tools that they need." Like, you need to get this stuff right, and you need to be buttoned up.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
And I think what State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke was saying was, "You were not coordinating with us on this. That was not buttoned up. And you're jeopardizing the legitimate investigations of some of this stuff by doing these political stunts." Like, this is really serious work. And I think the mayor has not treated it that way in terms of implementing policy. And it's not just with this. We also saw recent reporting, really good reporting from Alice Ian at the Chicago Tribune with the crisis response teams for police, which was a massive campaign promise of Johnson, not just sending police to public safety incidents, but sending mental health professionals as well. Most people totally on board with this, by the way. But the implementation has been, quote, floundering. And that's been because there is a political goal, but not a professional implementation of a lot of this stuff. So I think people should recognize when they're being played in that way on a serious issue like this, and that happened.
Well, has the state's attorney's office, in anybody's estimation or reporting, been doing these things, like not the political will of the mayor, but just because it would be right to do? If these people are shooting people who haven't committed a crime, shouldn't there be charges? Shouldn't there be an investigation? And is O'Neill Burke's office doing that?
No, I mean, I think you're right, John. I think, but you know, I in terms of jurisdictional issues, it was unclear to me. But certainly, regular rank and file police officers are prosecuted. You think of Jason Van Dyke, who shot and killed Laquan McDonald, was prosecuted, and so it can happen. It should happen. But Eileen O'Neill Burke does seem like she wants to make nice with the feds a little bit, doesn't want to get in their way. So I wonder about that. What Austin was saying about how Johnson has a lot of political goals but not a lot of follow-through or even understanding of what's going on may help explain why Superintendent Snelling up and quit. I know he doesn't like to say so, but it does seem like working under Brandon Johnson, whose opinion of law enforcement has always been a little low and who has contradicted or gone against the wishes of Snelling on several key issues like ShotSpotter, he might have just said, you know what, I don't need to be part of this amateur hour here. I can retire and go fishing.
Wonder how bad that job is then under those circumstances, because it is so important and it was believed that he was doing a good job. A lot of our jobs suck because we don't like our boss or our boss isn't very good at it. But doggone it, don't give up on us. We need you. We need this force to be corralled and used efficiently. He said, you know when it's time. It's time. And I'm like, well, why is it time? What happened?
In the middle of the summer is
going
time?
On there, I feel like. I mean, this is a person who, if I read this correctly, is retiring 2 months shy of being fully vested in his pension. Why would you do that? I mean, I know this summer is the hardest time, but hanging in there for two more months.
That's why you are
strange.
In that position.
I thought it was strange.
Yeah. Austin's got his finger over his lips like he's going to say something profound, but possibly not.
I think I've not seen anything to suggest that it was anything other than a person who's been in the Chicago Police Department for more than 30 years finally saying this is an extremely stressful position. I mean, if you think of what he's gone through too, I mean, he went through the first part of Operation Midway Blitz, was right in the middle of that, was given constant in the middle of what the mayor was saying and what the state's attorney was saying. He had to kind of stake out his own position. I thought he handled himself very, very well. But I think there's just extraordinary pressure on that position. I do think it's an opportunity, rather than, I think we talked about this last week or a couple weeks ago, rather than adding more police bureaucracy, which is another initiative of the Johnson administration, another office about gun safety, on top of the already at least 8 different local government bodies responsible for policing, to get competent leadership that reports to one boss, one police commission, because it's not just ICE. It's not just dealing with ICE. It's not just this, community safety kind of response or mental health response. The consent decree, we're still only 25% of the way through on. There's some huge structural changes we need to make the Chicago Police Department to increase professionalism and better public safety outcomes. And I fear that it just gets mired in this political debate all the time with people trying to score points. And we can't afford that in Chicago anymore.
NBC reported this week that nearly one-third of Illinois counties have voted to explore creating a new state separate from Cook County, and 7 more could join the movement this November. People in almost 40% of our counties have or likely will vote to secede from Illinois. I should say that that does not represent 40% of the population. Many of those counties are sparsely populated, but rather than responding to these efforts with snark or condescension, the Tribune's editorial position was we should see them as cries for help. Downstate is not heard. They're upset with the gerrymandered state that we're in and the corruption and the high taxes and the mismanagement of state funding. Some sympathy is called for. You know, my gut reaction to these stories, and they come up periodically, is Cook County and the collar counties are funding them. And I do think it would help their cause if they would put forward candidates unlike Darren Bailey we can talk about Darren Bailey in a minute. But Eric, what's your reaction to the annual movement of some counties to leave Illinois?
Well, my basic reaction would be let them go. You know, they are statistically going to be taking more money from the state than they're sending to us. They're takers, not givers, as far as that goes. But as precedent, as something that we would do in this country, it would just be a really bad road to go down. You would have all kinds of states wanting to carve themselves out, and it would change these state boundaries all the time. And it would further silo our politics, which are already, I think, too siloed, too divisive, that I would rather have these states down there as part of Illinois, as part of a balancing act. Because, you know, yeah, I am sympathetic to the Democratic Party, and I like that I live in a blue state, but I don't want Indiana to become even redder and Illinois to become even bluer, because I don't think that's necessarily good for the country to have states like that, to have us separate like that. So even though my first reaction is just like, you know, heck, go. We don't really want you guys taking our tax dollars down there. Go join Indiana. Have fun. As I think about it calmly, I think, no, let's not start doing that.
Yeah, I felt kind of sheepish when I read that editorial, because I, too, gave it very short shrift in the past.
Yeah.
And that, I really feel like some, like my dad came and gave me a lecture. You're right, Dad. It's not good that our state is so insanely gerrymandered. The Princeton Gerrymandering Project gives Illinois an F for how we're districted. Democrats take 14 out of the 17 congressional districts, and Republicans, if it was, you know, partitioned fairly, should have at least 3 more seats. So that's still not going to give them a majority. The majority of the state population-wise is still Democratic, but they are definitely being silenced and not represented well in their state government or in Congress. The districts themselves are more polarized, more Republican or more Democrat, and that means for the primaries, the candidates are catering to the most extreme base of the party to get elected. And then we get people like Representative Mary Miller.
Some of these counties are like, no, we'll form our own sub-state. We'll be independent of Indiana and Illinois. You will be the poorest state in the union if you did that in southeastern Illinois. You know, you're inclined to say have at it, but I don't wish that on them. And the Tribune wrote this: imagine how frustrated you have to be to support the creation of a new state. Some sympathy is called for.
This has been a dynamic since the start of the growth of the city of Chicago. So my name's Austin. I'm named after my great-great-grandfather's name's August Berg, who was an immigrant who came through Chicago in the late 1800s to settle in central Illinois outside of Effingham. And there's been this Berg family farm outside of Effingham for more than 150 years. And the beauty of that story to me is that August would have been coming through Chicago at the time when Chicago was not only the fastest growing city in Illinois or the Midwest or the country, it was the fastest growing city in the history of the world. It went from 300,000 people in 1870 to 1.7 million by 1900. And the reason for that incredible dynamism and growth was the synergy between central Illinois and the city. It was the fact that you had all this concentrated human capital in the city that was able to take the bounty of the hinterlands and turn it into commodities that would go all across the country. And part of the origin of this whole rivalry or hatred even between downstate and the city was really that grain. It started with that grain. There's a great book called Nature's Metropolis. It tells the story of when the Board of Trade was founded, you could finally buy grain that was just graded AAA grain. It wasn't like Farmer August's grain. It was grade AAA. And downstate had massive skepticism of the city of Chicago because they thought the process of grading was corrupt and people were bribing the graders. And it's been just skepticism and distrust ever since about Chicago corrupt politics and downstate interests. I think the Tribune is correct to say this is a cry for something, cry for help, cry for attention. And you not only need to fix it through fixing gerrymandering, but also it's almost impossible to get a statewide ballot on any issue of consequence, a statewide referendum on any issue of consequence in Illinois. In the last 50 years, there's only been one citizen-initiated referendum that's ever passed in the state, and it was reducing the size of the General Assembly, the cutback amendment brought by Governor Quinn. So you need to give people an actual voice in their government, and if it's not through their choice of a state representative or a congressperson, like, it needs to be through something substantive on the ballot that people can put forth for the state to vote on.
You know, you remind me, I've mentioned that book about the summer of 1927 that Bill Bryson wrote. And in there, he said that at the time that Charles Lindbergh was flying in the 1920s, the city of Chicago was the fourth most populous city in the world. It was Paris. It was London. I don't know what number three was. It might have been New York. But Chicago was the fourth most populous city on the planet. That description of its rapid growth, though, is fascinating. But I still think that while this story is about downstaters not feeling represented, it's also Republican downstate that's not represented. And I do want to talk a little bit about Darren Bailey, or why is it that the Republican Party can't get any traction? And I think when they do put people like him up, and I have some personal sympathy for his family situation, and in some ways he seems like a nice or smart enough guy, but his politics just won't play in the state. Why is it that the Republican Party, if they did want better representation, if downstate wanted to feel heard, get somebody that Chicago will listen to? And Darren Bailey is not that.
I totally agree with you, John, but that is exactly what I was talking about before. I mean, the reason the Republicans have extreme candidates in large part is because of how extremely gerrymandered our districts are. They have to cater to the most extreme elements of their party. He didn't just insult Chicago a lot during the last governor's race.
He's taken it back.
A couple years before that.
He has apologized for that.
Before that, he actually introduced a resolution to kick Chicago out of Illinois.
So, Darren Bailey can't blame on state on gerrymandering because he ran a statewide primary, so that was just who Republicans picked.
I think Kate's point, Kate interpreter, is that this gerrymandering leads to more extreme politics on all sides.
That it
filters out candidates. So it's a statewide election. He won, but the gerrymandering does tend to concentrate people and it tends to reward extremism. I will say that we have
It's statewide, but people are still voting, you know, within their districts, within this, thing that we have set up in each district of this, you know, vicious cycle.
Right. And in my time in Chicago, we've had, in terms of Republican governors, we've had Jim Thompson, Jim Edgar, George Ryan, and Bruce Rauner. So it's not like it's Republican Party has nothing. Ken Griffin, who is a big source of their funding, has moved to Florida after giving his money to the Museum of Science and Industry. And I don't know if Mr. Uline is as involved in Illinois politics. It feels to me like they have decided that it's throwing good money after bad, and they're going to put their money into other causes and candidates maybe elsewhere. But I mean, it is sort of a downward spiral for Illinois Republicans, and I could certainly understand their frustration. And again, I don't know what you would do about it.
Well, think out of the box. I mean, we're not saying anything that isn't apparent and hasn't happened before. Think out of the box. Vote what you might think is against your own interest in not electing the most or nominating the most extreme candidate, but giving us somebody who is more palatable to a blue state.
Well, there's a clear pathway for Republicans winning statewide, and you got to win at least 20% of the vote in the city of Chicago. And you got to rack up probably a little bit more than that. Darren Bailey has proven that he can't do that. I'm sympathetic to Darren Bailey. The Bergs, who are still responsible for that farm, have the same accent as Darren Bailey. Oh. And it's a very unique, not quite Southern accent. It is a specific Central Illinois accent that a few thousand people have. Darren Bailey has it, and all the, my family that lives down there has that. And but you see him doing political stunts, like this thing we're talking about before we started taping, of pulling up J.B. Pritzker's like weird high school yearbook to try to get attention, when the playbook, again, is clear. You got to win a bunch of Chicago. You have to be very clearly pro-choice also. You can't take a position on that, or you have to completely just like remove yourself from that debate entirely, which he hasn't done. And you got to talk about cost of living. You should only be talking about cost of living in this race. J.B. Pritzker, currently, his tollway board is considering the largest passenger toll hike in the history of Illinois. Like, it's going to cost people several hundred dollars a year. That's all. I would be going to every single public meeting of the tollway board saying, "I'm Darren Bailey. I won't hike your tolls. I'm gonna cut them." Right. But I don't really even know if he's running a race at this point. He hasn't raised any money. He's not talking about issues.
He's not making a lot of waves.
The whole yearbook thing is so strange, because he started out going in the opposite direction, apologizing to Chicagoans for bad-mouthing us last time, doing a little tour of Chicago and being seen at various restaurants. He specifically came out against, was it probably, who was it who posted, I guess it was Trump, who posted a cartoon or something of J.B. Pritzker to make him look especially fat. Do you remember what that was about?
Yeah.
And Darren Bailey came out and was against that, specifically spoke against that. And then Pritzker was very, you know, obviously solicitous, but it seemed in a sincere way when Darren Bailey unfortunately had that terrible tragedy in his family, where several family members got killed in that helicopter crash. So it looked like we were headed towards a slightly more civil gubernatorial election or campaign. So this whole thing of him bringing up J.B. Pritzker's yearbook makes absolutely no sense. I mean, who is not embarrassed by their high school yearbook? Everyone is. Who does not sympathize with J.B. Pritzker now for having that dragged out into public?
Let's just back up for a second, because Eric brought this to my attention, maybe yours as well. Maybe everybody's familiar with it, but it's new to me today. So, Eric, what is Darren Bailey's campaign doing with J.B. Pritzker's high school yearbook?
J.B. graduated from a boarding school in Massachusetts, south of Boston, back in 1982. And it was a small enough school, about 170 graduates a year, that they can have one of those yearbooks that basically gives a whole page or half a page to everybody. And they include all kinds of in-jokes and just like obscure references that, gee, only we're going to get. And we're going to look back on this in a few years and we'll giggle about these, you know, these strange words we've used and so on. And so there's this picture of JB looking extremely dorky, and underneath is a whole bunch of just little quotes or words or allusions to things. You just don't know what they're talking about. It's like Dr. Pepper, fishing, Phil's lamp, the Sucrets box. I mean, things like that. And then there's some things that are a little weird, like peeping or BM's BJs and drugged for drugs. My favorite one is phimpsing.
What is that?
I don't know. Oh. Phimpsing. I mean, it's like it's an in-joke
between these two boys.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't show up in Urban Dictionary, although I think that it should now.
It will now.
But it's like, I am so glad. Anyway. I went to a big high school. There were 600 graduates or so. Our yearbook did not have room to have these things in it. Thank God. You know, I mean, all the dumb stuff.
So what is Darren Bailey doing with this? What has he done?
He is showing his desperation and immaturity.
But is he pulling words from here and saying, is this a campaign ad?
So, or hey, what did you mean by drug for drugs, JB? My guess is that, I mean, looking at Pritzker back, he looked like he was kind of a nerd, that maybe they were smoking pot in 1982 in high school, and Bailey thinks this is going to be an issue in the campaign. I mean, it's just so, it was low, but it was just stupid low. And you wonder, like, Is he listening to anyone's advice? Did he go to someone and go, hey, look, I got his yearbook in 1982. They'll go, yes, Jamie, or yes, Darren, run with that.
That's Oppo research for these guys right now.
It's very funny.
The page has three pictures. The top half of it is J.B. Pritzker. I had that sweater shirt combination. And then underneath is two pictures of them. It looks like one of them is drinking from some sort of bottle. The other is the two of them just laying in the grass and they're smiling. And then all of these weird word combinations underneath. The in-jokes. Blanket parties. Phil's lamp. BU language. The walks. The adventurer. Dot, dot, dot. Ellipses between all of these words and phrases. Austin, if you were on the You Advise campaigns, Austin, what would your advice have been if they came to you with this page?
Fired. Whoever brought it forth, you're fired. I mean, or like, if you really have a bee in your bonnet about it, send it to some like kooky conspiracy website or something.
Let them handle it.
Should any campaign be touching that?
Eric, I'll ask you also just to lead, because you also spent some time in the Picayune Sentinel writing about Father Flager. Three strikes, and he's still not out. What's the Father Flager story, Michael Flager?
The Father Flager story is that a woman has come forward and saying that in the early to mid-90s, when she was a student at St. Sabina, where he is the pastor, that he sexually abused her in some way. I'm just not clear exactly what that accusation is, and that the archdiocese has removed him from the pulpit, and I think from the community, while they conduct an investigation. This is the third time that people have come forward. I think there are a total of five, and this is the third incident, where they have suspended Father Flager temporarily. The first two times, I wrote one column, and the first time it came out, I said, let's not judge this too quickly. I used the same headline a couple years later, and I'm using the same headline now, which is, in the first two times, the archdiocese has said those allegations were unfounded.
Today, you would still say, wait until the facts come out, or let the church do a thorough investigation?
Yeah, I would let the church do an investigation myself, I think it's okay that they remove him from the pulpit while they're investigating. There's probably not an imminent danger there. These allegations are all very, very old. He's 77. And I would think that they could have handled it more quietly, but maybe he wouldn't let them handle it quietly. I don't know.
Do we know anything about the accusers in this case, Eric?
No, I have not read anything particular about her other than that Flager says that he does not remember her as a student at all. You can argue this either way. You can say, well, obviously he's going to say he doesn't remember her. And obviously she would wait to come forward, because victims of child sex abuse often wait decades to come forward. And when they do come forward, they're often pilloried as opportunists and money grabbers and things like that. So it's very difficult. These things are very, very hard to prove. I don't know exactly what the archdiocese found in the previous investigations, whether they said, well, we just can't be sure enough to ruin this man's reputation and his career over this, so we're going to let him back, or if they said this is complete nonsense, we're not going to dignify it at all. I just don't know. I don't know what they find, but I think that the urge to rush to judgment on either side, and I've heard from both sides since I published this on Tuesday, I've heard from people saying like, he's a great man. He's a great leader. These are people who are his opponents. They're trying to get money and so on. And other people who say, hey, there's so much smoke here. There's got to be fire. How can you be so generous to this man when there's clearly all these accusations against him? And my view would be that, like, let's let the investigation play out. And that seems like the fair thing to do. But maybe I'm being too generous, or maybe I'm being too cynical. I don't know.
My default position on stories like this is to believe the accuser anymore. At least, maybe it should have always been that way, but I've sure thought about it a lot since Me Too. And I don't see what the upside is for somebody to come forward with something like this. The pattern seems to make sense. People wait a long time before they're willing to come to grips with it. And then it takes some courage or some moment, and then they come forward with the accusation. I don't know anything about this woman. I know nothing about this woman. I don't even know if she was a student of his, say, when when they were in school. But if there's a shred of credibility to it, then I start from maybe what the church has done. You have to at least take them away from the pulpit, take them away from kids, and then see what happens. That's a blanket. It's so unfair to apply to anybody, but that's my starting point.
Given the history of, unfortunately, the large child sex abuse with priests that's been going on now since, I forget, the 80s, the 90s? I forget exactly when it really sprang up into view.
When did Spotlight come out?
Given how much the church completely mishandled cases, it really does need to take every single case 100% seriously for people to trust them. So I don't think, especially when someone is in the position of authority of a priest, that you can just say, well, we think maybe this accusation will turn out to be unfounded and let him stay on. I think they are right to follow a rigid formula. They follow a procedure that says he does need to step back. I would tend to give Father Flager more the benefit of the doubt based on the fact that there have been five previous accusations. None of them apparently have been substantiated either in court or by the Catholic Church.
It's a conundrum, isn't it? Because the guy does a lot of good work. I suppose he could still have his civic career.
Now, if the church throws him out, he's completely done as a civic force, I think.
They're not going to throw him out unless they find credible reasons.
Right,
and if he's had to sideline himself from pastoral duties before and gone through this procedure and come back.
But there aren't criminal charges.
That can't happen again.
There's no criminal charges against him right now.
But what I'm saying is,
if nothing is substantiated, why can't he come back again?
Well, you know, you're right, Kate, but what I'm saying is, if he is found liable, whatever the ruling would be, it's not guilt or innocence, it's not a criminal matter, but if the archdiocese says, you're done, we find that this is a credible allegation, Flager is done also, I think, as a community activist. There's no way someone with that reputation can go out and campaign for causes and so on. So,
given his past experience, at least be deserving of withholding of judgment, regardless. And as a very prominent, highly political, highly opinionated public figure, you may expect, I'm not besmirching the motives of this person at all, but it's not that similar to accusations. He faces a different context than a priest in the middle of nowhere who was abusive towards children and people are coming out later. This is someone who's been really prominent in the public life for many years, and these previous allegations have been investigated and he's been exonerated. At the same time, I totally agree with Kate that you have to treat all these extremely seriously on a case-by-case basis, and that should have no bearing on this investigation of this accusation.
I'm going to leave it there. Eric wanted to talk a little bit about daylight savings time. Saving time. Some people get bad when you say savings time.
I thought it was savings.
No, you get in trouble.
That's what I say.
Wait, am I wrong? Is it daylight?
No, you're right. It's saving. Saving.
Saving time.
Saving. Saving time, yeah.
Because you're saving daylight time. Well, let's talk about that next week. I want to do our red light, yellow light, green light segment. And I also will notice that we got a bit of a green light from
Mike Pesca. It is, what a loss for Mike Pesca.
You know, when I read that he was no longer going to do his podcast, I felt his pain. He talked about how you do this, it takes a lot of effort, and you do it for a long time, and you've got a community of listeners. But at some point, you feel like there are better ways to spend your time or to be more productive. He said that he's not going to do the gist anymore. And in his closing remarks on his last podcast, he had a laundry list of podcasts that he still wants people to listen to and recommend.
So, yeah, he said, I listen to a lot of city-specific shows. For Chicago, it's the Mincing Rascals. and Pesca is a former NPR reporter. He was with Slate, and his podcast is based in New York. He's one of the first daily news interview podcasters. It's a real loss that he's leaving. But I was really thrilled to hear him call us out during his final show.
Is very exciting to hear.
And a loss for people who appreciated what he was doing. If you are one of those just listeners, welcome to the Mincing Rascals podcast. We like to close with something we call the red light, the yellow light, the green light. My yellow light is the city funding for the soccer stadium that the Fire are going to have in the South Loop. I think it's a good idea. I'm a little bit worried about it because things are never as good as they promise. But boy, is the owner of that team lucky. Like, just when the city and the state don't want to do anything for the Bears, just when the World Cup has caught fire in America, he needs some help from the city of Chicago. He's still going to fund almost to the tune of $1 billion of his own dollars, a soccer stadium. Hello, Bears. But he's going to need some infrastructure support, and the city seems to be on board very quickly. They have a very ambitious hope to try and get that thing up and running in 28. That ain't going to happen. But my yellow light then is, with caution, I'm waving the soccer flag.
I will give a green light to a show that I really, really wish I could attend tomorrow night, and I can't, but it's one of the free shows at Millennium Park at Pritzker Pavilion, which is a gem of our city. And this concert series is a gem of Chicago. The guy playing tomorrow is a Brazilian artist named Marcos Valle. And last year, I told everybody, you got to go see this Brazilian band, Novos Baianos, at Pritzker Pavilion. Marcos Valle is on another level, even beyond Novos Baianos, in terms of his legendary status in Brazilian music. It will be an incredible show. If you've never heard Brazilian music, have no idea what I'm talking about, have no idea who this guy is, you should still go. It will be really fun and really good. And you won't have another chance to see him again.
This is Thursday night?
Thursday night, Pritzker Pavilion.
Yeah, free. You have the album. Swing by Austin's house, and he'll throw on some vinyl for you, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. I do have Marcos Valle vinyl. He's the best.
I'm going to, with heavy heart, give a yellow light for the last season of The Bear. Maybe we want to do a whole discussion on that after we figure everybody has seen the entire season. I mean, I watched it, but you should not finish a series out of obligation and spend, most of the time pausing and saying to each other, can you believe that? it shouldn't be that way. If you're a big Bear fan, you're going to want to watch it, but just be ready for the fact that they're all, just kind of like how some people, as they age, they get more and more concentrated, and they either become way, way nicer or way, way more awful. The Bear has just settled into its worst faults and taken them all to the absolute limit in this last season.
That's interesting you should say that. I'm halfway through the last season, and it is very tense. I don't want to give anything away either. It's so far, it's been very tense and kind of depressing and gloomy. And I don't think it's giving anything
That's
away
the Bear.
To say there's a
big comedy, right?
There's a huge thunderstorm in the background, at least through the first half. I don't know if it keeps up, but Joanna's like not sure she wants to finish the season. I said, come on, we've been with this series all along. We got a few more episodes.
Well, you
got to
stay for Tom Skilling. Come on,
is Tom Skilling in there?
Oh yeah. No! Okay, oh no! Well, you didn't know that.
I think I can still watch it.
I think pretty much everyone knows they're going to get a Tom Skilling sighting in there, and that's fun.
My green light, I'm featuring this in the Picayune Sentinel tomorrow, is the song Trombone by Nick Lowe. We went to see Nick Lowe play at the Square Roots Festival up in Lincoln Square. He gave a great show. Guy is 77, and he's got it going on, and he's got a bunch of songs that people know. I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
And What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, and Cruel to Be Kind. Oh, but he played this song that I'd never heard before called Trombone. It's not on his 25 Best Of album. It was a really great song, and Nick Lowe is fabulous. It was really a great time, so...
Search him out.
Have you played Christmas at the Airport at Songs of Good Cheer, Eric? That's a Christmas song of his. That's very good.
Really? Christmas at the Airport.
Is it a good
Nick Lowe? Okay.
Is it a good sing along?
I think so. Great chorus.
Yeah, you should include a whole little Nick Lowe playlist of his best songs, not just the best, but things like that. That wouldn't have been for me.
I'll be posting a link to the playlist on his album, but I'm going to post the video of Trombone. See if you like it. I think it's a great song.
It's Eric Zorn and Kate Plies and Austin Berg. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another episode on you next week.
I want to say that this podcast is almost as long as it takes to be trained for body cameras.
By this time,
it's 2 to 4 hours, it says online. And also, Kate is right that Larry Snelling left just shortly before his pension was fully vested. But he's still going to make more than $200,000 a year and pensions.
But how much did he leave on the table?
I know.
I'm not saying that there's going to be a horrible scandal that will come out, but I feel like there's got to be some reason to leave that money on the table.
Yeah, I agree.
Usually it's the opposite. People stick it out to the very end to get that next grade up in there. All right. Good research on the fly there, Mr. Zorn. Thank you.
Okay.
See you later, everybody.
See you, Austin. Bye, Kate.
Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.